Hey folks, it's Jed Wolpaw here with just a quick message. We have switched over to a new platform, and you may start hearing some ads along with the episodes. This is really a way that we can continue to pay the growing cost of the services we need to keep the podcast coming to you without having to charge listeners. So we really want to keep the content free, and so we're going to start introducing some ads, and so if you hear them, you'll know what's going on. All right, thanks so much for listening, and enjoy the show.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, and welcome back to ACRAC. I'm Jed Wolpaw, and I am thrilled to have with me today a guest to talk about an unusual but really important topic in anesthesiology, which is environmental sustainability. So this is something I think a lot of people don't know a ton about or don't think about anywhere near as much as we should. And I'm really thrilled that I was put in touch with Dr. Shreya Agarwal from Northwestern. She's an assistant professor of anesthesiology at Northwestern, and she's really taken an interest in this. It's going to help us learn more about it today. So Shreya, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
So let's just start by asking you a little about you. Tell me about you. Where did you train? You're obviously at Northwestern now. How'd you get there? And what kind of practice do you have?
Yeah, so I am a generalist at Northwestern. You know, I trained down in Texas, in Houston, at the University of Texas, and kind of made my way up here to Chicago. So just going from one extreme weather situation to another. And I started thinking about all this waste that we have in the operating room, and kind of what our practices are. And I started realizing that, you know, there's a big environmental impact in what we do on a daily basis, that sometimes, you know, when you're in the thick of things and you're going through your cases and taking care of your patients, you're just so focused on delivering these safe, well thought out anesthetics that you just, it's hard to think about what all you're doing beyond that and how some of these decisions that you're making or ways that you're delivering things can impact the environment. So I started asking questions, I started reading, and then that's kind of how I started developing a practice that I find to be a lot more long-term sustainable for my career, but also for the environment, because I do think that we have a big impact in what we're doing as anesthesiologists that's a little bit more unique to other people in healthcare.
Yeah, interesting. And we'll definitely get into that. I am curious, you know, obviously, so you did you develop this in, or when did you start asking yourself this question of, do we have an impact on the environment? Was it when you were a resident? Was it after? Because I think, you know, obviously all of us in anesthesia go through the same basic training, and yet most of us don't ask that question. So what was it in you? Had you had an interest in this prior to being in medicine, or did somebody mention it to you and you thought, oh, that's interesting, I want to pursue it?
I don't know if I had like a aha moment necessarily, but it was just, yeah, as a resident, I started thinking about all the stuff, you know. I was trained, as most people are, that you should be prepared as best as possible for your cases and for your patient and for the inevitable. And a lot of times that interpretation ends up being having all the things out, all the drugs drawn up, everything available. And then I would turn around at the end of the case and there was just this pile of stuff that I wasn't using. And it became a pattern, right? Came a pattern at the end of every case, at the end of every day, that there was just a pile of drugs that I never even touched, or equipment. And I had it there because I wanted to be prepared. I wanted to be safe. But it really wasn't necessary. And then that's when it really got me to think, like, should I be doing it this way or should I be doing it differently?
Yeah. Well, that's great. I'm so glad you did, because I think so many of us, you know, have that pile of stuff and don't think twice about it. But I'm glad you did. And I'm glad you're going to help us to think about it. So why don't we start very basic with the question of, when we say environmental sustainability, what exactly does that mean?
Yeah. So, you know, we talk a lot about do no harm in medicine. And so sustainability is just kind of extending that out into the environment. And it's this idea of not being harmful to our environment on a global scale. So that you're not depleting natural resources or impacting this long-term ecological balance. And so when we talk about this, a lot of it is revolved around reducing our carbon footprint and our carbon emissions and our greenhouse gas emissions as a healthcare sector. Because the reality is that the healthcare sector is actually, especially here in the US, it's the second largest contributor to landfills, which then creates this huge carbon footprint that contributes to global warming, should you believe in global warming. So, and just for reference, the largest contributor to that is the food industry and how much it contributes, right? So when we talk about this impact, it's profound globally, but it's especially more so here in the US. And, you know, you can talk about how, because we're a first world country and we have these different standards of healthcare that we want to provide this really high impact, meaningful care to our patients, we're still the highest here in North America compared to other countries in Europe, in South America, certainly Asia. And so when you start looking at other first world countries that have similar healthcare outcomes, why are we having such a impact on our carbon dioxide emissions that other people don't have, right? And I think that's kind of where it comes down to, like, maybe there is something that we can change in our practice here to do that, because we also know that the more greenhouse gas emissions that are put out into the atmosphere, the greater the impact on our global warming and our climate change, and that impacts health, right? Because we know that climate change results in heat-related disorders, right? Those extreme temperatures of heat and cold, as we're all seeing. There's an increase in respiratory problems secondary to these allergens that are being produced, the air pollution. There's an increase in vectors causing infectious disease and waterborne illnesses. And you get a lot of, like, physical injuries and dehydration, dementia, depression with these extreme weathers. So you kind of get into this, like, revolving circle, so to speak, of there's this impact on health because of climate change, which then needs more healthcare. And if we continue with the same healthcare trajectory that we have been, it's just going to become this vicious cycle, right? Because we're going to be producing more greenhouse gas emissions, which are then just going to continue to create this warming of the earth and the climate change.
Right. So it's interesting. You're exactly. I mean, this is such a good way to think about it. I mean, I've even heard that there's theories that, you know, the increasing rates of fungal infections may be related to climate change, because as fungi adapt to warmer temperatures, they are no longer as inhibited by our body temperature as they once were, because they're more used to higher temperatures. And so whereas the 98.6 used to be high enough to kill most fungal infections, now it's becoming more and more not enough because they're used to higher temperatures in the environment. So there's a ton of health related outcomes here. And of course, as we're recording this right now, there are, you know, unheard of cold temperatures in Texas. And certainly, you know, you said you trained out there. I hope if you have family there, they're doing okay. And certainly any listeners who've been affected by what's going on in Texas and across the South, hope everyone is doing all right. So So yes, there's a huge impact. And I hadn't really conceptualized it the way you just said, but that idea of a vicious cycle where the more health, poor health outcomes that are caused by global warming, the more health care we need, which then produces more bad, you know, greenhouse gas emissions. So I want to talk, hear from you about kind of two aspects. We'll zero in on anesthesiology in a minute, but let's start more globally. You know, the healthcare industry in general, what is it about our healthcare industry in this country that is so bad? Why are we such a producer of negative impact on the environment in a way that even, as you said, other countries with similar health outcomes or even better health outcomes are not? What are we doing wrong?
Yeah, I mean, that's a pretty loaded question there, right? I think, and you're not going to probably find this written in literature, or at least I haven't seen it yet. This is kind of like my personal opinion. I think a lot of what we do in healthcare is around this idea of patient safety and infection, this idea of like nosocomial infections, that we're going to somehow do that. And so we tend to have a practice where we rely all very heavily on disposable items, right? So in the operating room, disposable gowns, disposable pulse ox probes, right? We don't really want to expose patient A to patient B's equipment that we use, right? Even though we have clearly established that there are ways, not for every single thing, but for many things, to disinfect them in a way that we wouldn't need to do that. But we kind of put it under this cover of, well, it's safer for the patient if we don't expose them to patient A stuff by making sure it's disposable. A patient goes home, that stuff gets thrown away. And so I think that...
Mm-hmm. Sorry, no, I was just going to say, do you think that the kind of device companies that are making, let's just, for example, say, you know, the laryngoscope blades, right? I mean, you know, when probably, certainly when I was training, probably when you were training, right, there, we didn't have disposable laryngoscopes. They were all reusable. And now it seems like everything, as you said, is disposable. Laryngoscope blades, there's disposable fiber optic scopes, everything. And it seems to me, and I don't know, I could be wrong, but it seems like what an opportunity for the device companies, right? Instead of selling you a laryngoscope blade, which you then are going to use for the rest of your life, and you never have to go back to them to buy more, now you've got a, they've got a continuing supply they have to deliver to you, or they get to sell to you, right? I mean, there must be a push. And maybe the excuse being given is what you're saying, which is that this decreases infections, but it must also be driven by profit for the industry.
Well, so, I mean, you know, the thing is that there's also this idea of this cross-contamination with the disposable, but also there's a big component of it's labor intensive. So who's cleaning that equipment in between? And how much does it cost to get it clean, right? So there's also utilizing those ecological resources, like those toxic cleaning solutions. And sometimes people feel that it's faster, right, just to not have to clean it, or maybe they don't have the support system to do that. Because generally speaking, it's not you and I that are disinfecting those laryngoscope blades, right? Yeah. We have an entire support team dedicated to that, but are they overextended or, you know, whatever? So, I think that plays a part in it too. And realistically, when people are making these decisions, a lot of it is about the efficacy and the ease of use for these, like the monitors or the blades, right? Like, am I going to get that same outcome that I want by using this on my patient? Going back to that patient safety aspect of, am I delivering the best anesthetic care? And then two, the cost. But very rarely are people thinking about the environmental consideration of that, right? So I don't know that, and maybe they are, right? Depending on which company you're talking about. Maybe some manufacturers are pushing towards reusable, but it's almost like they're just meeting that demand from us. as
I was actually wondering if the companies are incentivized to move away from reusable to move toward disposable, right? I mean, clearly they are going to make more money if every month they have to sell you a bunch of new plates.
Sure. But we are also asking for that demand.
Yeah.
Right?
Sure.
I mean, just look at the pandemic. Like, you couldn't get Lysol wipes anywhere, right? But how many people were going on Amazon looking for Lysol wipes versus how many people were looking for a spray bottle and some reusable cloths to clean? Do you know what I mean? Like the demand is still there for these companies to say, yes, you know, we'll do that. And yeah, we can make a lot of money off of it. So I think when you, if you have the opportunity to think about what equipment is being purchased, there should be this component of the environmental consideration. And there's actually something called life cycle assessments that can be done to have that component weighed in so that you're making the right choice, right? Because when you look at the life cycle assessment, you're looking at how much of the environmental factors or how many resources went into making something like a steel laryngoscope blade, which is obviously more intensive at the beginning, right? You're using more resources, but then you're going to use it forever versus a reusable blade that's going to be easier to make because it's made out of aluminum and it's cheaper and it's flimsy. But over the course of however many times, you know, you're going to need so many, right?
Right.
And I think a lot of times people aren't doing that.
Is there any data to suggest that reusable equipment does decrease the risk of nosocomial infections?
To decrease the risk? I'm not sure.
I'm sorry. I said reusable, but I meant disposable. That disposable equipment decreases the risk of nosocomial infections. In other words, if you aren't reusing things, is there anything to suggest that that is actually helpful for infection?
I don't know that I've seen that, right? But I think we've seen data to say that you're not at an increased risk if you're properly disinfecting the reusable equipment.
Okay.
In whatever way the manufacturer intended. Okay. I do want to go back to the manufacturer piece, though, because there are manufacturers that do have recycling and reprocessing programs. So although, yes, they are incentivized to sell you like the reusable stuff, right? Of course, they're going to make a lot of money off of it. I do think that there are enough programs that we probably don't take advantage of in terms of reprocessing equipment. And what I mean by that is where you take a certain device and you send it back to a manufacturer and they go through very rigorous processes for cleaning and sterilizing that device. They retest it. They ensure it meets FDA standards and then they resell that device at a lower cost. Mm-hmm. So they're still making money off of that device, right? But it has gone through stringent regulations because this is all, dictated by the FDA, and there are actually, you know, regulations around this, and they have to be registered so that it's safe for our patients. And again, I don't know how many practices or institutions are optimizing that reprocessing program for a lot of these manufacturers.
Yeah,
that's there's great a lot of room for purchasing improvement there as well.
Yeah. Okay. So when we say there's this big environmental footprint that the healthcare system has, is it one thing we've talked about obviously is waste, right? Is throwing stuff away. There's also greenhouse gas emissions just from the nature of the fact that these are large buildings with, you know, large machines that are putting out gas. I mean, what is that aspect of it?
Yeah. So, you know, when you start looking at the amount of energy that it takes to run a normal hospital, right, or a clinic, in terms of the lights, the air conditioning or the heat or all the medical devices, right? All that starts adding up and then the medical devices tend to take more energy, right? And then you start talking about the amount of waste, obviously, but then also the amount of the drugs that are used and the other resources that are put into play. The laundering services, right? When you start talking about patient gowns and patient blankets and all that stuff, that's what all adds up into this waste production for our U.S. healthcare system. So, you know, in when you look at the amount of the global warming potential from healthcare, most of it is actually from hospital systems and not so much from these individual like physician clinic facilities, if you will. And actually the second largest global warming potential contributor is actually from prescription drugs. So like from pharmaceuticals. So if you start talking about healthcare as a whole, it would rank like number 13 in the world for the amount of greenhouse gas emissions that are put out once you start taking in all these different components. Okay. And our anesthetic gases actually are a big contributor to that as well. And we can talk about that more later.
Yeah. So I was going to ask, but, you know, when, so there's obviously there's the whole healthcare system. And I think you pointed out, you know, the amount of energy it takes to keep a giant hospital going and wash everything and heat and et cetera, et cetera. There's the waste of materials and the cleaning of materials. You mentioned the toxic chemicals that are used to clean things that are reusable. And then those obviously are going to end up somewhere. Mm-hmm. And then there is the purchasing and throwing away of disposable. So really, whether you have disposable or reusable, there's still kind of negative environmental impact in some way.
Right. And that's where you have to really think about your actual each individual thing, right? Like, and where is that risk benefit situation? Because right. It's not going to be the same for each one.
Right, right. And you mentioned there are services that will help hospitals think through this, like where, you know, what is the right or best at least choice for a given situation?
Yeah.
Okay. So what about anesthesia specifically? So obviously, you know, we have a unique practice. We're using gases that no one else is using. As well as some materials that aren't being used, at least not as extensively elsewhere, like endotracheal tubes. Obviously, the ICU is also using them, but we use them a lot. What's the impact of what we do in anesthesia?
Yeah. So when you start looking at the healthcare industry, right, about 30% of that, I said before, you know, most of it's coming from hospitals. And from the hospitals, about 30% of that's coming from the OR. And a lot of that is all the surgical equipment, right? Like the sterile drapes and the supplies, but at least a quarter of that is from our anesthetic contribution. So I think there's a lot of room to improve, right? Once you start talking about this stuff. And when you start talking about where that is, I think there's a couple big components of that, right? So the inhalationals that we use, our equipment, but then also how are we disposing of our waste, right? So a lot of times, you know, so everyone knows in the operating room, you have all these different receptacles that your waste can go into. When you're done with an IV bag or your syringe full of propofol or, you know, your vial, what have you, right? Are you going to put it in the trash can? Are you going to put it in the sharps container? Are you going to put it in like a blue box or a black box? And a lot of times things just go in the trash, just like a regular trash can, and they shouldn't be there. And that's a big deal because when you put things that aren't supposed to go in the normal trash can, it gets sent to the landfill and it leaks out into the soil, and then that goes into our water supply, right? And that's why we have all this data now about the ecosystems changing and all the poor fish, you know, having to deal with all these things in their water supply, and the fish are dying and sea life is changing. And then, you know, I have this fridge now that filters out like antidepressants and like Xanax. It's got a special filter on it because all this stuff is in our water supply, right? Because people are just dumping it down the drain or into the trash can and then it seeps out. But also a lot of times I see people putting things that shouldn't be in the sharps container in the sharps container. And that becomes a big deal because when you talk about this waste stream management, if you start thinking about how, what happens downstream, if you take that Sharps container and think about what's going to happen with it, that stuff is getting incinerated, which is all then contributing to this carbon footprint, right? So now if you have things like Sharps in there, that makes sense. But if you start adding paper or, you know, I've seen all kinds of stuff in there, right? Like that shouldn't be in there. Then you're just incinerating it. And that's a terrible thing to do for the environment. It's also actually very high cost for the hospitals as well, because most facilities are charging or are being charged for this stuff according to how it's being processed later down the road, right? Because it's more expensive to put something on a truck and send it to an incinerator than it is to just put in a landfill.
All right, hang in there. We'll be right back.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
So it seems to me like in the OR, there are maybe two broad categories of, at least on the anesthesia side, there's the actual gases that we use, and then there's the waste of kind of the stuff that we use. So let me ask you about the gases. I think most places in this country, you're going to have a choice between desflurane, sevoflurane, and isoflurane, and nitrous oxide, you know, plus or minus nitrous. What do we know about the impact of those gases? I mean, they must, you know, they're not, we don't reuse them, right? They get scavenged. I mean, there's a certain amount of reuse in the circle system, but, you know, whatever is not getting rebreathed by the patient is getting scavenged. It's not going out into the OR, so it's getting scavenged, and presumably it is getting evacuated into the environment. So what is the impact of the gases we use, and are some worse than others?
Yeah, that's exactly right. So because the vast majority of our inhalationals are not being metabolized, right? It's such a small portion. Most of it is being scavenged, and then it's being vented intact into the atmosphere, essentially, right? So what happens to that gas afterwards, right? That's like the, then that becomes a question. Well, most of these gases, all of these gases, they end up staying in the atmosphere for some amount of time. And that time is variable depending on which inhalational. But it stays there until it finally degrades in the atmosphere. And that longer lifetime of being in the atmosphere allows for that continued atmospheric warming, which when you start thinking about what that does, if you think about it on a basic perspective, you will deliver an anesthetic. And depending on which gas you use, if you use nitrous oxide, the atmospheric lifetime of nitrous oxide is 114 years. So if I give a patient nitrous today, it's going to be there in the air long after I'm gone. I mean, I'll be dead, and that will still be there, right? That's a big deal. So our actions actually have a big impact versus if you use a gas like sevoflurane, that's in the atmosphere for about a year. ISO lasts a little bit longer, about 3 years. And then you have desflurane, which is about 14 years, right? So when you start looking at your gases and you start thinking about you're going to do this every day for somewhere between like 1 and 10 cases a day for, you know, a 30-year career, right? It becomes a really big deal when you think about how long these gases are in the environment. We also know the global warming potential for our inhalationals. And when you take, when we talk about this stuff, we talk about the global warming potential over 100 years, and they kind of set carbon dioxide as one to make it easy for everyone. Sevoflurane has a global warming potential of 130 versus does flooring, which is on the other end of the spectrum, and it's like over 2,500. So really, there's no reason to be using DES fluorine. And a lot of places still have that available. And I would highly encourage people to think about, do they really need DES fluorine? Is there any benefit that their patient is getting specifically from using DES fluorine versus a different inhalational like sevoflurane?
Yeah.
Because when you look at them, when you compare sevoflurane, isoflurane, and DES fluorine, sevoflurane then becomes the most environmentally inhalational gas that we have.
Environmentally friendly.
Yes, sorry.
Yeah.
So is there a reason to be using DES fluorine? Is there a reason to be using isoflurane? That's not as bad as DES fluorine, but you know, you really have to start thinking about these nuances, right? Is that quick on and off that a lot of people talk about with DES fluorine, is that worth it? Or can you achieve the same thing with sevoflurane and just time your anesthetic accordingly?
Right. So right? I want to emphasize this because I think this is really important. So what you said is that DES fluorine, first of all, lasts significantly longer than sevoflurane. So I think you said 14 years versus about a year. And then while it's there, has 2,500 times the warming effect of carbon dioxide, where SIVO has about 130 times the warming effect of carbon dioxide. Is that right?
Yeah, it's something about, to that effect.
Yeah, give or take. I mean, so...
And that's in comparison to carbon dioxide, right? And when we talk about carbon footprint, we're using carbon dioxide.
Right, yeah.
So the point being that the carbon footprint of these gases is much higher than just carbon dioxide. And that's like kind of what gets the big buzz in non-healthcare sectors, right? When you talk about other industries like the car industry or aviation.
Yeah.
So I think our anesthetics, like we don't hear about it as much because they're not regulated, right, by the government or by other societies, because they're considered to be medically essential. And I think part of that too is because initially it wasn't really known what a big deal it was. So we've been able to just kind of practice without having any regulation. And I'm not saying that we should have regulation, that's not the point, but I think it's important to talk about that we should have some responsibility in how we're using them then.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I think it, you know, it certainly seems like choosing sevoflurane over DES fluorine when there's that big of a difference in impact is pretty, you know, straightforward. I mean, you could imagine, what if we changed it from environmental impact to cost? So what if DES fluorine cost, you know, 2,500 times more than sevoflurane, right? No one would ever use DES fluorine. It's this kind of what it feels to people like a little more amorphous, right? The hospital doesn't, and neither does the anesthesiologist feel the immediate impact. And yet it's striking, as you said, I mean, you know, thousands of anesthesiologists over decades of practice making these choices, and that has some significant impact. Okay, so gases, you know, the worst offenders, it sounds like, being DES fluorine and nitrous oxide. Mm-hmm.
And I think there's still a lot of people that, you know, like to have nitrous as part of their gas mix. And again, I would just say, you know, I'm not here to tell people how to practice, right? That's not the point of this talk, but I think it's important to weigh that in your risk-benefit considerations of, do you need that nitrous? Like, is it really adding to your MAC? Because we know that it's very minimal amount, right? And is it providing you with that effect that you really need, or can you achieve it other ways? And then the other part too of this is your fresh gas flows. So the fresh gas flow will determine the amount of gas that's entering the scavenger per minute. And so once you exceed the patient's requirement based on, you know, your ventilatory parameters, that's how much it's going to end up out in the atmosphere. So I would really encourage people to consider doing efficient fresh gas flows, right? So low flow anesthesia is kind of what we talk about here, because, and there's a lot of different strategies to do this, but I think the simplest way to do it is just to drop your flows during the maintenance phase of anesthesia. And for most situations, that's less than a liter total.
Yeah. And it's really interesting, you know, in this country, we are still taught and are teaching our trainees that sevoflurane needs at least 2 liters per minute. And yet when I've had guests from other countries, they think we're crazy because the data is pretty clear that that's not true, that it's totally safe to use lower flows with sevoflurane. And we could probably do even better in terms of, we could clearly do even better in terms of our environmental impact if we moved away from that.
Right. Yeah. And I think that goes back to that people feel like they're risking something for the patient by dropping the flows, and you're not going to.
Right.
You would have to drop them very, very low.
Right.
But that's just not, clinically, it's really not that big of an issue. And I think that people should feel confident dropping their flows.
Yeah. Okay. So what do you recommend? I mean, we kind of moved on to the question of what can people do. So one obvious thing is low flow. If you're going to use inhaled anesthetics, low flow, try to avoid desflurane, try to avoid nitrous oxide, stick to SIVO or ISO, better SIVO than ISO. What else can people do? You mentioned that there are, most ORs in our ORs, there's a blue recycling bin, there's a red blood bin, and a gray regular trash bin. You know, I think most of the time we use them as three interchangeable trash bins. Mm-hmm. So obviously one thing is paying attention to, and trying to put things that can be recycled in the recycling bin. What other things can people do to try to mitigate their impact on the environment as they practice?
Yeah. So, you know, I just think being mindful in the operating room about what you're doing will go a long way. And so what I mean by that is, think about like what you're setting up and what your patient needs, right? Just even going through your day-to-day, like routine, appy case, OR setup, and making that distinction between what is necessary for providing that good, safe, well thought out anesthetic and what you're doing just because that's how you set up your room or that's how you always do it. And it goes back to that piece of like, you know, a lot of us, that's how we were trained to do it, or that's how we're being trained to do it. And, you know, I'm at an academic center too. And I can tell sometimes that, our residents are doing something because, you know, they're just trying so hard to be a good resident, and they had someone tell them do something, and they just want to make sure that people understand that they're taking that feedback and they're doing it that way. Right. And they don't want to get in trouble. And they're trying to find their way. Right. But do you need that or not? Like, do you need, three different sizes of oral endotracheal tubes available for this routine appendectomy? Or can you just have the one that you think is going to be the best fit? And that's the one that you have open and, you know, maybe styleted, and just have the other ones available nearby, but not open. Even that just makes a big difference, because generally speaking, if you open something, it's going to end up in a trash can at some point.
Yeah.
Either because that's your institutional policy that at the end of the day that gets thrown away, or at the end of the week, you know, maybe the anesthesia techs are going to come by and throw it away, or maybe it gets gross because now it has blood on it, or it has, you know, some saliva on it, and you're going to throw it away anyway. So, I think if you start thinking about, okay, I'm going to have it available in case something doesn't go right, and then I'll just reach for it because I know exactly where it is and I know I'm prepared in this room with it, versus I need to have it right next to my laryngoscope. It might be a little uncomfortable sometimes, and certainly not for those situations where you have a high likelihood of needing something, right? Because you have to be safe. But for normal situations, I don't think that you need to have three endotracheal tubes out, or, you know, all the size oral airways out. You know, at my institution, one of the things that we initiated was that the blood pressure cuff was going to follow the patient wherever they went in the hospital. So, which probably doesn't seem like a big deal, but you know, sometimes they get one blood pressure, and this is disposable, right? Sometimes they get a blood pressure cuff at the beginning out in pre-op, and then they get another one in the operating room, and then they get another one in recovery, and then they go to the floor, and it just all starts adding up because along the way things get tossed. But they don't need that, right? Because if they're appropriately sized, they should just need the one, right? Yep. Just really simple things. I will routinely take the, if the pulse ox isn't working and I can't use a reusable one, because I think that's a great opportunity to have a reusable monitor, is a pulse ox probe. A lot of places they, or people prefer to use the disposable one. But then if they don't get a good reading, they just put another one on. Well, generally speaking, you can peel off the sticker and put it on a different finger, you know, or the earlobe. And I think sometimes we don't even think about it. It doesn't actually take that long. You know, I've seen people cut gowns because they didn't want to untie the knot, you know. These are like simple things. And sometimes it only takes a minute to do.
Yeah.
But people don't really think about it. You know, I can go on and on, but I use a lot of donuts, those pink donuts, right, for the head. Mm-hmm. And I save the inside of the circle to use for padding elsewhere. Instead of getting another towel to pad the patient somewhere else. Or if I'm putting in another IV, I don't necessarily spike it with a whole new IV bag if it's just a backup IV, because I know I'm going to have poor access and I'm not planning on giving a lot of fluids or drugs through it, right? It's just a just in case IV. I just Heplog and put an extension on it, because now I'm not wasting a whole IV bag and a whole setup.
Yeah.
You know, there's a lot of examples like this, yeah. Right?
Not to mention you're not over flooding your patient with fluid.
Right. Exactly. You know, I think there's like little ways that you can do things so that if something happens, you are still prepared, but just being more mindful. And then certainly decreasing the amount of drug waste, right? Just drop what you need. You don't need to have things in line necessarily. If you don't anticipate your patient needing pressors, do you need to have them in line, right? Ready to go.
Right. Once it's in line, it's done. Obviously, you can't reuse
right.
it.
Right, exactly. It and that's a lot of pharmaceutical waste. And, you know, I think we've all seen drug shortages, right? And we don't really talk about the impact that we talk a lot about how there's a drug shortage because of manufacturing. But we also have a component that, too. It's because a lot of times we're just wasting them.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, I think pre-filled syringes are so key for this.
Right.
Right. Because, right. you know, I obviously, if I don't have any pre-filled syringes, I'm not going to start a case without mixing up a bag of phenylephrine or something, right? So that I can have a push dose. But if I have a sealed pre-filled syringe of phenylephrine, then okay, I don't need to necessarily open it. And if I need it, I need it. If not, it's totally sterile. It's still usable. I can have it ready for the next case. So that, I know it's an investment on the part of pharmacy. I know it takes labor for them to prepare these, but from an environmental impact standpoint, it can save a lot of waste.
Yes. I'm so glad that you brought those up, because I do think that that really is the way of the future in terms of drug waste. And I think that it would make a really impactful thing if we can get more institutions to do that. Now, certainly having those vasopressors even, I think, is a big deal. And then, you know, like the Anesthesia Patient Safety Foundation has talked about this a lot from a patient safety standpoint of having the pre-filled syringes. But from an environmental standpoint, you're right. You don't need a whole bag of phenylephrine for most cases.
Yeah. You know, you use the word mindful, and I think that that strikes me as like the underlying message is that so often we aren't mindful of our potential impact on the environment. I think for a lot of us, it's because we just didn't think about it. No one ever told us, and we didn't ever think about it ourselves. And so it's literally not something on our radar. So it's not that we're deciding that we don't care. It's that we don't even know to think. And so I'm hoping that this will be a wake-up call to a lot of people to say, there are little things that won't waste a lot of my time and won't negatively inconvenience me or my patient, but that I could just keep in mind, be mindful of in the OR, and could make a big difference. And I think that's really key. Shreya, are there major things that we haven't covered that you want to make sure we hit before we move on?
You know, I could talk about this stuff all day, so that's kind of a loaded question.
Well, yeah. Let me say this. Are there any last messages or recommendations that you want to get out to the audience? A general one can certainly be, look into this more, because there's a lot more to it and a lot more things you can do. But are there things that you would think, man, like I have to make sure that people hear this before we end?
Yeah, no, I just think, kind of think about it, go through, even just as a mental exercise, if you're interested at all about the impact that you're having, just go through, in your next case, when you're in the OR and things have settled down, is there anything here that I found that I don't typically need or that I could do a little bit different? And just start looking around and seeing what's going on. And I think, we have a responsibility to our patients, but we also really do have a responsibility to the environment that we live in, right? Because we're seeing all these things happen that people talk about, these historical temperatures, these pandemics that we're now in, right? And sometimes it doesn't necessarily translate as used S4A, I turned up my fresh gas flows and I took some stuff out and now people's asthma is flaring up too much, right? That's not the connection that we have, but that's kind of where things are going, right? And the WHO has put out a lot of data on this. I think we're going to link some of it later about how much for environmental impact on disease, that burden is 22% on a global scale.
Yeah. Yeah, that's pretty striking. Well, this is really important stuff, and I'm really glad that you have highlighted this for us. And as you said, I would highly encourage people to think more about this, seek more information. We'll put some links that you recommend in the show notes, and people can look more into it. Let's move to the portion of our show where we make random recommendations. Do you have something that you would recommend to the audience as they continue to look for ways to keep entertained when they're not socializing that they can check out? I'll give you a minute to think about it while I share a shout out from an audience member, Matthew Shannon, who recently graduated from anesthesiologist assistant school, recommends that folks check out the White Coat Investor podcast. He said it's taught him so much about finances, which ironically nobody ever seriously teaches you about, as well as how to use my income to actually serve me, both short-term and long-term. So great recommendation. Check it out. All right, Shreya, back to you.
Yeah, right now, I have two little kiddos, so the best thing that I can recommend is sleep. But other than that, we've been cooking a lot. That's kind of our activity. And so there's this pizza dough that we use a lot, and it's just fun because we get dirty and messy, and we, who doesn't like pizza? We've just been doing a lot of at-home dance parties and just kind of relaxing that way. So
nice. That's fun. The pizza dough is great to know about. And maybe if you send me that recipe, I'll put it in the show notes as well, if folks want to check it out. I will shout out a podcast. In a prior episode, I talked about Axios Today, which is Axios is a news organization. They do this nice little morning podcast about the kind of news of the day. But they also recently did a 6-episode kind of mini series. It was reported by Jonathan Swan, who covered Trump from, I think, before he was ever president and then through his presidency. And it's really interesting. He delves really in depth with the question of, how did Trump decide to contest the election results? What led to that decision? How did it proceed? And then how did that lead to January 6th and the Capitol riots? And it's, he does such a good job of the reporting, and he talks to people really on the inside who were there in the room for a lot of these discussions. And it's really interesting. It really sheds a lot of light on how we got to January 6th. And I highly recommend it for anyone, regardless of your political leanings, but just who is interested in knowing more about how we arrived at the kind of craziness that happened on January 6th. So I recommend checking that out. Shreya, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you so much.
All right. That was great. I think this is such important stuff and something we just don't think about that much. But let us know what you thought. Go to the website, acrac.com, where you can leave a comment and others can learn from what you have to say. Maybe you have some tips that we didn't think of to help reduce the impact of our practice on the environment. You can also join the conversation on Twitter. I'm at Jay Walpaw, and we're at ACRAC Podcast, and you can also join the Facebook group. If you are a fan of the show, please consider going to Apple Podcasts or whatever podcast app you use and leaving a comment and a rating. It will help others find the show. If you're interested in supporting the making of the show, you can go to patreon.com/ACRAC. That's patreon.com/ACRAC, where you can become a patron of the show. Even if it's just a dollar or two that you pledge, it makes a big difference and we really appreciate it. You can, of course, make individual donations anytime you want by going to paypal.me/ACRAC or looking up Jay Walpaw on Venmo. Thank you so much to those who have already made donations and become patrons. We really appreciate it. Big thanks, as always, to Dr. Brian Park, our tech lead, to April Liu, who is our social media manager, and to Dr. Kimia Kashkuli, who is helping out with some of the show notes. Our original ACRAC music is by Dr. Dennis Kuo. You can check out his website at studymusicproject.com. All right, that is it for today. For the ACRAC Podcast and Dr. Shreya Agarwal, I'm Jed Walpaw. Thanks for listening. Remember, what you're doing out there every day is really important and valued.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.